Welcome to the Future and Seeking Delphi, episode number 8, Inventing the Local Future. I'm Mark Sackler. When you tell somebody you're a futurist, you often get a snarky response. Something like, okay, predict my future. As any futurist knows, predicting the future is a dicey business. We construct scenarios, sometimes make forecasts, and try to help steer organizations and society as a whole towards anticipating change and choosing better long-term alternatives. Over 150 years ago, Abraham Lincoln said that the best way to predict your future is to create it. More recently, computer scientist Alan Kay said that the best way to predict the future is to invent it. When we think of the state of today's digital world, it recalls visionaries who in the past were inventing a future that is now our present. Names like Alan Turing, Steven Jobs, and Tim Berners-Lee come to mind. And as for inventing the futures of energy, transportation, and space travel, hardly a day goes by without hearing the name Elon Musk. But what about the rest of us? We can't all be Steven Jobs or Elon Musk. Beyond creating our own personal future, is there anything the rest of us can do to create a better world? Neil Richardson is co-author, along with Rick Smyer, of Preparing for a World That Doesn't Exist Yet. They suggest that there is. Both are significant players in Communities of the Future. It's an organization dedicated to better decision-making at the local level in a rapidly changing world. I spoke recently with Neil about the book and Communities of the Future. Neil, welcome to Seeking Delphi.
I'm really happy to be here this morning. Thanks for inviting me on.
Neil, let's begin with a little bit. If you can give me just a little bit of your background and what brought you to write this book along with your co-author, Rick Smyer.
Well, I'm currently director of continuing education at the University of the District of Columbia. And I'm also the founder of a consulting organization called Emergent Action. And Emergent Action is part of a network of futurists and people who want to understand how to work the future better. It's called Communities of the Future. And it's a 25-year-old organization with about 400 folks that are involved in this. And it was started by my co-author of our book, Preparing for a World That Doesn't Exist Yet, Rick Smyer, and a whole bunch of other smart folks a couple decades ago. But it's continued to evolve. And the ideas in the book are actually representative of not just Rick and I, but also these 400 really engaged and wonderful people.
Tell me a little more about the Communities of the Future, the mission, what you're doing. What have you been able to accomplish so far?
So the idea is to work with leaders of all types on change. And so in the network, we have urban planners, we've got economic developers, we've got coaches that work one-on-one with people and involving leaders. We've got psychologists. We've got a whole variety of folks and deans of schools and CEOs of companies. So we've got this really engaged network of people that want to understand change. And then one of the things that we've probably gravitated towards is change in local communities. And the scale is right. You know, changing an entire society or an entire planet is a big chunk to kind of take out all with one bite. But we've found that working in mid to smaller communities and or organizations, a lot of the ideas that we talk about in our book are applicable. And so we've worked in communities and organizations.
So effectively, this is an attempt to actually apply the philosophy of thinking globally and acting locally?
There you go. Exactly.
In the book, a theme that starts out right from the beginning is the notion of a second enlightenment. Talk to us about that and what that means and how it may or may not be accomplished.
Well, you know, our book is hopeful. You know, when you, a lot of futurists, not that they're cynics, but a lot of futurists are quite frankly afraid of the future. And there's, of course, there's a lot of scenarios to cause us to be afraid. But our book and our ideas and the folks we work with are hopeful. We do think the next 10 years are going to be a little bit rocky. And if we can survive the next 10 years, I think things are going to look good. But our understanding of the different scenarios that we've looked at is that once this, the boomers kind of die out, a new generation of leadership begins to sort of take hold of things, both Gen X and the millennials, because they're going to be back in the, you know, when the way boomers approach leadership is you basically don't become a leader until you become a certain age and you've had certain experiences. The way we see the future, it's going to be purely based on talent, based on ability to do things. But that's kind of another story. But our concept of a second enlightenment is that every few hundred years, Western civilization has seemed to change and transform. Peter Drucker had a really good quote about that. And Peter said that we're living through such a time now. And he said this about 10 or probably 15 years ago. And what we're seeing is this, in this transitional time, which we also call the integral age, depending on what group I'm talking with, you know, we might call, you know, we'll call it the second enlightenment, or we'll call it the integral age. But this transitional time is really interesting because for the very first time in history, there's actually at least four economies in churn simultaneously. And so each of those economies has a different mindset. So we've got obviously a manufacturing economy going on, you know, we're in the last stages of that here in the United States and in parts of the West, and that is, you know, less depending on who you speak with. But we're also in a knowledge economy that we've been in, you know, that much of the country and much of the Western Hemisphere has been in for the last 10, 15 years. But there's still the vestiges of an agricultural economy. And there's a new economy that we see emerging now called the creative molecular economy, which is a much more organic and different. So in this transitional era, which is going to be dynamic and it's going to be very unpredictable, but again, we think it's going to be hopeful, we believe that the world is going to end up in a place which is much more harmonious in a way that we're going to be working together in smaller groups of dialogue and groups of scale. And we get there through different kinds of dialogue, which we call futures generative dialogue. But we're going to get there despite the unpredictability and the friction that we're all going to experience. But the original enlightenment surfaced out of Glasgow and Paris and Rome. And it, like today, the first enlightenment sort of started in pubs and outside of the church and outside of universities. They were all coming out of the revolt against the church. And so reason became really important in the first enlightenment. And so it bubbled up actually outside of the major institutions in society. And if you look around today, you see those same things happening. People are wanting to become more involved and engaged from the bottom up. And if there's something that we've seen over the last 40 or 50 years, certainly since the end of World War II, changes usually come from the top down. And right now, people want to become involved. And so the conversations and the change is happening much more at the grassroots level. And they're upset. People are upset when they don't have a way to get their voices heard. And I think that's some of the things we're experiencing with a recent election here in the United States.
Let's talk about some of the concepts that you discuss under the heading of the Second Enlightenment and what's going to empower it. And I'll start with one that you just mentioned, and that is creative molecular economy. Because the thing that came to mind with me when you got to that fourth economy was the sharing economy. Is that just another name for the sharing economy, or is the sharing economy part of it?
Certainly, yeah. I think that sharing economy is part of it. You know, the way, you know, Uber's, you know, who knows if we're going to own, probably not going to own certainly as many cars in the next 5, 10, 20 years. But when we talk about a creative molecular economy, it's about, you know, it's about Bitcoin. It's about different kinds of ways that we use money and we think about finance. In the past, since the monetary system's been developed, depending on who you talk to, you know, the last 300 or 400 years, it's kind of been based on a transactional thing, on a transactional approach or understanding. And it was kind of based on physics. You do one thing and that reaction is going to cause this action. We see the creative economy as more dynamic and molecular and probably based more on biological concepts than of rigid and predictable transactional concepts. And so the molecular economy is going to involve all kinds of questions about who owns what. I mean, how do we think of ownership? And is wealth and great and our riches really dependent on what's in our bank account, but what's in you know, our brains and our lives and our and the type of work that we do? So it's going to be more creative. So it's going to be the creative economy, the creative molecular economy is going to be, we think, drastically different than the current one, is going to take hold over the next 20 or 30, 40 years. And we think that's going to be it's going to be here for a long time once it does take hold. But Uber and Airbnb and things like that are certainly signals and trends that that's coming down the pike.
Let's move on to another concept in the book that I kind of find fascinating, but I'm having a little trouble getting my own arms around, and that is something you call the master capacity builder. Tell us about that and what that means.
Yeah, well, it's going to be critical, you know, if we make it to the next, 10 years, that people approach the world in a completely different way. And so we feel like one of the ways that we've seen this, we've seen positive things happen in society, are that people literally coach and mentor and manage and nudge people forward. And so the master capacities are literally skills that we teach emerging leaders on how to become more effective at change, you know, whether it's in their community or their organization or, you know, literally just their life. But there's, in sort of reframing the way that leaders think, we have to basically get people, transformative leaders thinking differently than making decisions based on short-term issues, and begin getting leaders to think about the long-term. And there's a whole series of things that we do in order to make that happen. It's not just a question of somebody, okay, yeah, I'm going to try to imagine what it's going to be like in 10 years. Well, there's actually exercises and there's techniques that we ask folks that we work with to use so that they can really take into account, maybe, you know, hopefully 7 generations like the Iroquois, you know, asked us to do, but certainly in midterm futures. And we're seeing that with a lot of companies. I think Unilever has been really good at using a lot of these ideas. There's other big, large corporations, and then there's also a lot of people that are using it more and more in their daily work.
Yeah, it seems to me that what you're really saying is that the master capacity builder is an activist futurist, or would that be a simpler way of putting it?
Yeah. You should have helped us write the book. Yeah, you. That was the certainly the kind of a quick synopsis. Yeah, we kind of see master capacities as sort of we call them transformational or integral leaders, and then we have other leaders who are traditional. And it's not a war between traditional leaders and transformational leaders. What we're really asking people to do is to embrace both. There are certain situations where you don't need anything super fancy, you know, and strategic planning, as we've been doing it for the last 50 years, is fine to use. But if you're working on an issue that is vexing and difficult and keeps reemerging, Well, you're probably going to have to look at another kind of approach to that, call it adaptive planning. And we don't ever try to get across the message that, you know, that old styles and traditional and conventional thinking is wrong. What we're simply asking is that you also add another layer to that. And again, we call these master capacities, and master capacity leaders try to do a better job at knowing when to use conventional processes and when to use transformational processes.
One final question involving a concept in your book that I would certainly like to hear more about, and that is you suggest something called polycentric democracy as kind of the future of governance. Explain that to us.
It's probably my favorite part of the book because it's the part of the book that I've had the most experience and joy working in. The concept was developed by Nick Hanauer, who co-wrote a book called The Gardens of Democracy a few years ago. And what the term means is that, again, the democracy is going through a transformation. It's worked well in the United States, technically have the oldest democracy on the planet. It's worked well for about 250 years, but we need to allow it to change. It's probably gone as far as it's going to go using the Constitution as this sort of really fundamentalist, strict way to govern and make decisions. What polycentric democracy and the technique that we call mobile collaborative governance does is it creates opportunities for ordinary residents and citizens who are engaged and decide to educate themselves on current issues to become a part of decision making. And so, for example, in Washington, D.C., where I've worked for three mayors here in the District of Columbia, and I was in charge of the strategic planning process around the turn of the century. And what we decided to do is the District of Columbia had come out of about 10 or 15 years of mismanagement. The federal government had taken it over because of the poor finances and the public services that we're getting. And the city hired a really sort of innovative, experimental mayor who wanted to change the way that the city worked fundamentally. And so we created a strategic planning process that asked the people to come in, the residents to actually come in and make decisions about how the discretionary budget of the city was going to be used. And so we created a dialogue process working with a really fantastic person named Carolyn Lukensmeyer. And we invited a whole bunch of people, thousands of people, down into the convention center. And a lot of folks said that, you know, a lot of the newspapers, the Washington Post, said, oh, nobody's going to come to that. First of all, they don't trust government. They don't know enough about this new mayor. And they don't think you're going to do what you're going to say. Well, we, over the course of several months and smaller planning projects around the city that culminated in what we called a citizen summit, 4,000 people showed up to the convention center and spent an entire day working with facilitators. We trained over 400 facilitators, so every 10 people got their own facilitators sitting at tables, and they worked through worksheets, and they helped us to decide how to use all the discretionary money in the district budget. And what that did is, number one, it brought in the public that had been pushed out of district government for a long time, and it put them in the decision-making capacity. Okay, well, this is what we've got three or four great policy choices. They're all good ideas, but we can only fund one or two of them. Let's talk about them together at the table and through this facilitated dialogue, and then we're going to make some decisions about what we feel like we need to do. And while we're doing the old-fashioned dialogue, which is the most critical thing we could have been done, we've also got it hooked up electronically. So each citizen's had a keypad. You know, this was back in 2001, before everybody had cell phones. But we were able to collect all the thoughts and a lot of like pure data just on people's keypads. And then while the conversations were being facilitated, We had note keepers that were writing things, and we're on big screens around the room. We were showing different ideas that were coming out of each table. And so it was a really fantastic first look at what kind of mobile collaborative democracy, polycentric democracy could be. And it's a way that governance can happen and should happen more and more, particularly since all of us can sit in front of a computer and we can look up, educate ourselves on policy issues. And through facilitated policy process, I think the government, particularly local government, ought to bring in people and bring in their ideas to work with the policy experts and to create the conversations and the dialogue between the experts who have been looking at this stuff for however many years they've been doing it, but also bringing in the new ideas and more ideas that the residents will bring in by a little bit broader search. And I've seen it work a number of times. I consulted with a council member here in the district, and we literally used this process to create her platform, which was a sea change, because a lot of politicians, when they run for election, they do a phone survey to decide, what are my priorities going to be? And so it comes back from a phone survey, and they parse all, do all the analytics, and they get the data. Well, the way that this council member did things is she went out and had facilitated dialogue, and we found out the key issues. But more importantly, or just as importantly, we found out how people talked about these issues and what were their connective points and their passions around these issues. So we got a lot of things beyond just the data point, whether they like something or don't like something. We actually heard about their values and their hopes and their aspirations and their concerns through this kind of policy making. So there's a lot of things that are happening around this. I think there needs to be more, but I think we're going to see more, hopefully. And the book's begun to generate some of the conversations, quite frankly, in different places around how particularly mid and small towns begin to work.
A theme that I picked up in the book, and you mentioned way back in the beginning of this interview, you mentioned the term integral. Can you explain to us what that is, what that entails? I mean, the futurists in our audience will understand it, but those that aren't trained futurists may not be familiar with the term.
The integral movement was sparked by the philosopher Ken Wilber probably about 20 years ago, and he was part of a movement called originally kind of moved out of transpersonalism, which was depth psychology, and included in that, they started including sociology, and they started including basically every sector of knowledge that was both the great discoveries of the West and also the wisdom of the East, and so they tried to combine that. A lot of this transpersonalism, the integral movement, became more formalized, and they started to look at the way that people and then also leaders evolve. And what they basically ask people to do, and it's a sophisticated system, but they ask people to really think about connecting the sort of the personal development with community organizational development, also the systems. And so when you're making decisions or you're doing anything in your life, you're considering at the same time or as simultaneously as you can do, what it's going to do for you, what it's going to do for the people around you, and what changes in the actual system that you're existing in need to be taken account of. And all three of those, all three or four of those quadrants are just as important, and they need to be taken into account. Because if you fix one thing, if you make a strong self, if you become a bodybuilder, and you make a really because you want to change your life. If you become a bodybuilder, but you're spending so much time in the gym that you're not actually going to look for work, and you're out of the job. Well, you fixed your health, and you've become much more healthy in one sector of your life, but you haven't spent enough time to go get the job you need in order to support your family. So it's kind of a simplistic view, but the whole notion is that you look at and take into account all parts of the system, both now, you use the context of the past, and then you also think about the future. And so I find the integral framework very compelling around whole system development. And I distinguish it between just systems theory, which I sometimes find does not take into account some of the spiritual aspects of people and systems, which is why I generally use the word integral rather than sort of systems theory.
Neil, thank you so much for your time, and best of luck with your continued good work in communities of the future going forward.
Thank you. This has been really fun. Yeah, I look forward to speaking with you in the future.
Preparing for a world that doesn't exist yet is essentially a blueprint for applying the mindset of a futurist to decision-making and planning in small to medium-sized communities, to inventing the local future. Links to this book on Amazon and Barnes & Noble can be found on the webpage for this podcast at seekingdelphi.com. In this week's news, EU Horizons 2020 is going all in on biocomputing. They've announced a 6 million euro grant to a team of researchers to develop a biocomputer that they hope will outperform quantum and conventional silicon-based computers. The device, if successful, will produce faster processing speeds at lower energy consumption levels than any computer currently in use. Next Big Future reported that India, China, and Japan will increase coal usage throughout the 2020s, potentially leading to more CO2 emissions and air pollution. They do plan to mitigate the damage with new technologies. However, it is noted that low-emission coal technologies still spew out 30% more CO2 than natural gas. Wired magazine reported that Facebook is working on an artificial intelligence algorithm to predict, and hopefully stop, suicides. Apparently, users broadcasting their suicide on Facebook is not seen as good for business. And finally, researchers at the Kyoto Advanced Telecommunications Research Institute have chosen to demonstrate the human mimicking capabilities of their robotic technology with a music video rap parody called Robots Delight.
I said a hip hop, the hickey to the hip, hip hop, and you don't stop a rocket to the bang bang.
I'm thinking the robot should keep its day job. Links to these stories can be found at the Seeking Delphi webpage for this broadcast. And don't forget that you can subscribe to these programs on YouTube and iTunes. As always, your comments, questions, and suggestions for future content are always welcome. Special thanks to my guest, Neil Richardson. My technical advisor is Mohammed Malouf. Until next time, I'm Mark Sackler.